Two Chairs No Waiting, episode number 318. Neil Brower interviews the Darlins from 2004. Two Chairs No Waiting is brought to you each week by the fine folks over at Weaver's Department Store. Drop by over at Weaver's and pick up some of the amazing Mayberry gifts and items they have there. They got t-shirts, sweatshirts, thermometers. You could use one of those right now. It's having a little cold snap going around. You got all kinds of things there at weaversdepartmentstore.com. Two Chairs No Waiting is also brought to you by donations from listeners just like you. The executive producer of Two Chairs No Waiting, episode number 318, is Ricky Lipscomb. Thank you, Ricky. Appreciate your support for the show. I am Alan Newsome, your host for Two Chairs No Waiting, your Mayberry podcast. And it is absolutely wonderful to have you here in Mayberry with me. And sharing a little bit of time just visiting and enjoying ourselves as we talk about our favorite show. Now, what we're going to have today and for the next 4 weeks, actually, and last week was really kind of all part of this, is from 2004. Now, these next four episodes are going to be from Neil Brower. Neil Brower has Professor Brower's class at Mayberry Days each year. He does it at other times throughout the year as well at the Andy Griffith Museum. So if you're going to be in Mount Airy, try to look at the calendar of events at the Andy Griffith Museum's website, and you can see when he's going to be having one of his classes, and you can attend. It's a lot of fun. We did that last summer as a group from here at Two Chairs No Waiting. We all met down at Mount Airy, depending on which direction you were coming from, and we're able to meet down in the theater, is what it's called, the little theater down at the bottom of the Andy Griffith Museum, and Neil did his Professor Brower class. So this is from 2004, and this episode, it includes the all the Darlins except for Briscoe Darlin, Denver Pyle, because he had passed away, of course, by the time this event occurred. But I know you're going to enjoy this because Neil interviews all the Darlins, which are the Dillards, which is you got Rodney Dillard, Dean Webb, Doug Dillard, Mitch Jane, and Charlene Maggie Peterson. They're all there. They're all there with Neil. So this is a fairly long interview, so I'm going to go ahead and let you head over that direction and hear from Neil. So, Neil, take it away. We're going to love this, guys.
Back a few months ago, the Eagles released another greatest hits CD, the very best of the Eagles, and the liner notes that come with this release were very extensive and very well done. Members of the band were interviewed about each song that appeared on the Greatest Hits album. One of the songs that appeared on this recent release was Midnight Flyer, and Don Henley is talking about the influences for this song. Let me read with you just a part of what he says. I was happy to do something in that vein. He's talking about bluegrass music, because I was a big bluegrass fan. The Dillards, in particular, had an enormous impact upon me. Along with Doug Dillard and Herb Henderson, Bernie Leadon, who was a member of the Eagles, was one of the top banjo players in the country. So I was proud to do a bluegrass tune that would lend a certain amount of credibility and authenticity to our band. A week ago last night, I went to Lenore, North Carolina. One of my favorite groups is the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band. They were playing in Lenore, and the program book that they handed out gives a history of the band, and let me read one paragraph to you. The Nitty Gritty Dirt Band grew from jams at McCabe's Guitar Shop in Long Beach, California, in the mid-1960s. With a group sound shaped by its members' influences. Now, these were the people that the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band admired. From the 50s rock and roll of Eddie Cochran, the Everly Brothers, and Elvis, to the popular folk music of the Kingston Trio, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and the Dillards. Wonderful group, wonderful influence. Mitch, Dean, Doug, and Rodney, how about coming out and joining me on stage? Now, we're not complete if we were talking about the Darling family. And I have to share with you just some personal thoughts about Maggie. First time I met Maggie was back in 1990. I was involved with the Charlotte 30th reunion show of the Andy Griffith Show. And I was very pleased that Maggie agreed to come. I did a lot of the show by myself, and the day that the cast members came in, I had gone back and forth from the hotel in downtown Charlotte to the Charlotte airport probably 10 or more times, and I was exhausted. Maggie's flight came in late at night. Jim Clark was at the hotel, and I said, Jim, how about if you'll drive and let's go out and get Maggie and just let me rest. Well, growing up, Maggie was one of my favorites. I thought she was prettier than Thelma Lou or Helen, and I really liked Maggie. Jim and I stood there waiting for her to come off the plane, and this was her flight, and I knew she was coming, and I was interested and excited to see her, and here she came off. Knew it was her instantly. We walked to the area where we were waiting for her luggage, and while we were waiting, she really opened up and just shared with us some real personal information about the Andy Griffith Show, and I could tell she was at ease with us, and we were at ease with her from the very start. She's always been an encourager. I've done two shows that I was involved in, and she was always very complimentary and encouraging as we would build up to the show the day or the hours before. She's been to Mayberry Days for year after year. She's a real wonderful person. So Maggie, wonderful person, come and join us. The format that we're going to follow, I'm going to begin with their early life and career. I'm going to ask each one. And then after we get to the point where they are on the Andy Griffith Show, we're going to see some clips. We're going to have clips from the show, and we'll have comments from the cast members, all of these wonderful people that join me here on stage. Doug, I want to begin with you. I think the story of the Dillers begins with you, Doug. Doug, yeah.
We're not that old.
Well, let's find out how old he is. When and where?
Began with my great. I can go on all day.
When and where were you born, Doug?
When and where?
Yeah.
I was born March the 6th, 1937, in St. Louis, Illinois, on the kitchen table between the black-eyed peas and the red-eyed gravy.
Now, share with us. See, I'm going to have to wait for Doug to get over this. Share with us the name of your mother and father, and what were their occupations?
My mother. my father, his name was Homer Earl Diller Sr. Rodney and I have an older brother who's a rocket scientist. He designed the Gemini and the Apollo rockets that went to the moon. He was head of the wiring system. How about them apples? my dad, he was a government meat inspector for Switzerland Company in St. Louis.
Okay.
East St. Louis, Illinois, and he actually put in the word and gave Switzerland Company the way to process sizzling.
Who were some of your early musical influences?
Me?
And what first introduced you to music, Doug?
My father and my mother's genes. Chromosomes. Yeah, the bluegrass chromosomes. That's how we call it, bluegrass chromosomes. Yeah.
And did they play music in your home?
Yeah, probably.
What age did you first begin playing an instrument?
Well, I started when I was just a little baby. You know, our mom and dad just had all kinds of instruments laying around. Said, don't you touch those things while we're gone.
And that made you want to play them, of course.
Of course. That was reverse psychology is what that's called.
You know?
But I started picking guitar behind my dad on the fiddle when I was about five.
So guitar would have been your first instrument.
That's right. And our mother played, Rodney and I, and our mother's the same.
I'm not sure.
I left him open for that one.
When did you get your first banjo, Doug?
I got it for Christmas When I was 15 years old, my dad, he always wanted a banjo picker in the family, so I was forced to.
And what type of banjo was it?
It was... It was a K banjo. It was a K banjo. I'm not endorsed. Yeah. I endorse Gibson now, but I have to say it's K. That's sort of my
first banjo. And you made that instrument your own. I read that. What did you do with the magnifying glass?
I burnt my initials in it. Right in the back of the resonator. So somebody stole it. I didn't know whose it was.
You want it back.
And I got one stolen once. It was gone for 7 years. And it was a miracle. Rodney never got his guitar back, did you, Rodney?
No.
Did you ever get your mandolin back, Dean? Did you? What did you get stolen, Mitch?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
Oh, yeah, well, I can see right now we got to move on down the road.
We're going to move on, okay? Who were some of your professional musical influences, Doug?
Pardon me?
Who were some of your professional musical influences?
Well, my father, first off, and Bill Monroe, Earl Scruggs, Ralph Stanley, John Reed on Red Smiley, the Osborne Brothers, J.D. Crow, and I could go on all day. But the main ones were Earl Scruggs was my idol on the banjo, for sure. I first heard Earl Scruggs when I was learning to drive a car, and I was driving down this old country road. And I turned on the radio, and Earl Scruggs come on with Earl's Breakdown. And I'd never heard a banjo pick like that before. Well, I ran off in the ditch. Had to get a tractor fully out, you know. And I told that story to Earl one time when it was his birthday on WSM. And I told him that story. He said, well, yeah. I'm glad you like my music, but I'm sorry you had so much bad luck.
Let's now go to Rodney. And we might want to move on quickly there, okay?
Sort of the yin and the yang here.
Yeah.
Oh, no. I know.
Rodney, when were you born?
I was born May 18th, 1942. I wasn't born where Douglas was. I was conceived there.
It wasn't between the black eyed peas.
But I was born a child. Yes.
And what instruments did you play as a child? What were the different ones you began on?
Well, when I was he's right about the story about mother putting the guitar. What a great way to do this. She put the guitar behind the couch and say, "Now, I don't want you boys touching that guitar." Of course, the minute she's out of the room, what are we doing? We're fighting over the guitar. But, Doug, you know, unfortunately, I never had the good experience he did about learning to play the guitar at an early age because he took it apart and couldn't put it back together again. So I had to experiment with other instruments, you know.
And who were some of your influences as far as people you like to listen to on the radio or on record?
You know, I liked Flat Scruggs and the Stanley Brothers. And the same people Douglas was talking about, because we both used to listen to those records and slow them down. Because Dad was an old-timey fiddle player. He didn't play that slick bluegrass stuff.
Yeah.
And so we had the experience of playing that kind of music and then sort of moving into the bluegrass thing.
Now, did you play trumpet in the high school band?
I thought you were going to bring that up, and how did you know?
Read it in a book. I did some research.
Yes, I played trumpet because I wanted to get out of the morning class and things, so it was a fun thing to do.
And now, is this correct? You were in elementary school, but you played in the high school band.
Yeah, first chair.
Isn't that unusual?
It is pretty unusual.
It is. I think it says a lot for your talent.
But I never did. I always felt like an outcast because I never could jam much with Douglas and Dad when I played the horn.
Yeah. And what about the influence of your Aunt Dolly McNeil? Did she have a big impact upon you?
Yeah, I was telling folks last night she's a terrible cook. So she taught me to really appreciate real food when I grew up. But she, as far as musically, she had no musical talent.
But she stayed with you and perhaps Doug when your father and mother were away.
Yeah, working in the city.
Yeah.
And she taught me a lot about the farm.
Now, after you graduated from high school, you went to Southern University.
Yeah, but it didn't hurt me.
It didn't hurt you.
I spent 2 weeks. It was 2 weeks before finals at SIU. And they have a thing in school, I don't know if they still do, where you take this test in the last year in high school, and it tells you whether you should be going to college or not. Yeah. Does anybody know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
What's it called?
SATs or college prep.
Are you a teacher?
Yeah.
Yeah, I am. So when I took this test, see, I'm going to tell you something, and I don't mind talking about it now because I'm not there, I'm not that person anymore, but when I was in high school, I had the reputation of being one of the few rhythm guitar players around the country. So all these good old boys, these old guys, these old fiddle players and banjo players would come and get me at noon, and we'd go out somewhere in the woods there and play music until I had to go back to school. Well, they had a tendency to pass the whiskey bottle. And so, unfortunately, I had the good sense enough not to drink any. So one day we stayed out and played on music. We came in when I was finishing the SAT test or whatever you call them then. And I got called into the office about a week later or something. I said, well, Dillard, you're wasting your life here. You know, you're trying to play this music. And the principal, I mean, the superintendent called me in. And just to give you an idea of how a negative input can really turn you around, he came in and said, you think you want to play music, huh? He says, you'll never make it in music. He says, I know. I played saxophone in the Navy. So here he is telling an impressionable kid that he's never going to make it in music. And I thought to myself then, you sucker, I'm going to show you. Because at that time, you know, that high school life is your whole life. Because you don't really know what they have in the future. So I took these tests, and the next day the principal came in and said, well, Dillard, it looks like you've got a couple people want to interview you because you're rated in the 97th percentile in the United States as somebody who might know something. And he says, next week you got these guys going to come and interview you for a scholarship. They want you to go to their school. So the next week I came in, and I was so hungover that I was sitting there with this guy from, I mean, not SIU, it was none of those schools down there, and he would sit and he'd be talking to me, and I'd say, yes, sir, yeah. I'll be right back. You know, so that was my last year of high school and my first year of college. 2 weeks before finals, I quit and went to Hollywood.
Now, you called...
I don't recommend anybody doing that at all. It was a dummy. But if I'd gone on to school and I would have graduated, no telling what I'd have become.
Rocket scientist.
A rocket scientist.
And Rodney, you called Doug.
Systems analysis.
You called Doug at that time. And Doug, you were working as what?
I was a brain surgeon.
No, I know that's not right.
No, I was an accountant.
Accountant, and Rodney said he's going to California, and what did
you
say?
Yeah, I said, no. Rodney said he was going to Nashville. I said, no, Rodney, let's go to California.
And you quit your job.
I quit my job.
And Rodney quit school.
Mm-hmm.
And with these two, you went.
Mitch, you quit your job.
Then we got fired.
Boy, did I.
Well, let's move to Dean Webb now. Dean, I'll ask you the same question. Where and when were you born?
March 28, 1937, in Independence, Missouri.
And what was the occupation and name of your parents?
My mother was a nurse by, you know, what she did most of her life. And when she wasn't, you know, having babies and so forth there, a short period of time, I have one brother. So, but she did go back to work after a while. And my dad, at that time, in the Second World War, he was running a gas station, because he was really too old to be in the Second World War, and he'd been a farmer during the period earlier on.
Now, what were or who were some of your musical influences as a young person?
Well, I had an uncle. My mother's brother. His name was Bob Crawford, and they were into Western music. And back at that time, because of all the movies that they put out, which was, I feel like it was almost like an equivalent of what we did. They went out to California and were in a bunch of those kind of movies with this Western music, because everybody, whether it's a Gene Autry movie or whatever, they all had the bunkhouse guys, you know, the cowhands were all musicians, actually. And it would be either Bob Wills's band or this band or whatever. But anyway, my uncle and his Texas Rangers is what they call their musical group, were in several movies with Gene Autry and Buster Crabbe and Tex Ritter, several of them. Anyway, they were Hollywood early period of time, early 40s and late 30s.
Now, which instrument did you start out on?
I had some cousins on the Webb side of the family that got interested in bluegrass, as I did, up in the high school period of time. I graduated in 55, so about in 54, they would start hearing more bluegrass on the radio, but still pretty scarce. And I liked it because it was rare. Everybody else was, you know, listening to the hit list, and you'd go to the record shop, and they'd show you what the 40 top hits. And I thought, that has nothing to do with what I want to buy for records. So I got all into this bluegrass because it was obscure, and I guess that's why I liked it particularly, maybe. I don't know.
And what influenced you to play the mandolin?
Well, I had one cousin that was playing the banjo, and his brother was playing the fiddle, and they had a friend who was playing guitar, so I thought, they're all doing pretty good. I don't necessarily want to play the same thing. Of course, the first thing you want to play is either the fiddle or the banjo, because that's what intrigues you first. But so I thought, well, I met somebody who had a mandolin, and I was able to buy it, you know, pretty reasonably at that point. And so I started with that, just to more or less play along with them rather than compete with them.
Now, how did you begin playing with Rodney and Doug?
Well, let's see, this by the time we're getting up to, say, 1960 or so, and we're doing a few things, and I was a friend down in the Ozark Mountains, a couple of different friends I knew who knew Doug and Rodney and so forth, because we would meet through different people in different shows, a guy by the name of Dale Sled and another guy by the name of Lonnie Hoppers, and they both played in a show at one time or another, Lee Mace and his Ozark Opera, wasn't that what they called it? And all the bluegrass pickers would go to the show one time or another, so the people on that show would meet all these other bluegrass people. So I had heard them mention these guys. And so finally, Dale Sled and myself went up to St. Louis, where guys were here were living at that time, and met up with them. And we did a little instrument swapping type things and jamming and whatever. And another fellow and myself, we also were involved with a TV show down in Springfield, Missouri. There was on Channel 10 down there, which is a CB affiliate down there. They had our thing was called the, Jim Walters Jubilee, we called it, and the shell homes that they would put out. So we had a TV show in Springfield, and one of them was on Saturday, and then another one in Joplin on Sunday. I forget which way around it was, but two shows there a week for this Jim Walter Shell Holmes. So we did that for a short period of time, and not too long after that, that's when we went up and I met Doug and Rodney, and we started thinking about California and so forth.
Okay, we've got three pieces of the puzzle together. We need one more. Mitch,
yes,
when and where were you born?
You really want to know, Neil.
Yes.
I was born July the 5th, 1928. Oh, I forgot I have one, don't I? I don't hear anything much. In 1928, and I was born in Indiana.
And what was the name of your parents, and what were their occupations?
My dad's name was Gus, and my mother's name was B, as an aunt. My mother was a housewife. I came from a family of three children. And my dad was a small-town lawyer in a little town. When we moved to Missouri, I was just a baby, we moved to Missouri, and we lived in a little town called Cahokia, Missouri, about the size of Mayberry, the film Mayberry, I think. And I grew up, did most of my growing up there, and then when my older brother went to college and my sister went to college, we moved to Columbia, so we wouldn't have to try to drive. It was during World War II, you couldn't get gas or tires. So Dad just moved the whole family up there and commenced lawyering up there.
Now, you didn't play music growing up, but you loved music. Is that correct?
I didn't do what?
You didn't play music. You didn't play an instrument growing up.
I took piano lessons like most kids. You know, I followed the piano, but that's about it.
Tell us a little bit about your Navy experience.
I was a tail gunner in torpedo bombers, and the war was just fresh over. And so all the pilots were left over from the war or to train the new pilots. And the new pilots were the average age of about 19, and they had, all had zits, and they all tried to do wheelies on the aircraft carrier. And my job was to fly facing backward. You couldn't face forward anyway. And I got to see every place we'd been. And I got to see what had just scared me to death.
And Mitch, did you write? You started writing in that period, didn't you?
Yeah.
And why did that? Why did you start writing at that time?
Well, there's nothing else to do in the turret of a torpedo bomber. You're not bombing anybody. You didn't carry any torpedoes. I'd scribble things in a notebook, but I'd always wanted to be a writer.
Now, see, what you need to know about this is important because he has the soul of a writer. When I was working on Mayberry 101, Mitch was my resource for the Dillards, the Darling episodes. And I would get back information. I wrote the book by corresponding through mail with different people. When I get back something from Mitch, I would get excited reading it because he put thought into it, intelligence into it, and it was well written. And I thought, I can do something with this. Mitch has the soul and the spirit of a writer, and that's important for y'all to know where it began. Now, once you got out of the Navy, you married and moved to the Ozarks.
Yes.
And tell us your occupation at that time.
Well, I taught one-room schools for 4 years, and I would have kept on teaching for another 4 or 5 because I'd gone down there. My first wife was from Eminence, and she had gone to a one-room school, and her mother had taught one-room schools. And when I was talking about the language, and the language in their family was absolutely wonderful, and I think looking back on it, which is easy to do over 60-some years, 50, don't make yourself older than you are, Mitch. Definitely. I think they had the most beautiful language. I had little school children who used words like principally, and my daddy plays the fiddle to beguile the time. And I'd never heard anybody use words like that. As a matter of fact, I don't think I had ever heard anybody use the word beguile unless they were singing it or reciting poetry. You know, a six-year-old child had never been to a day of school, used it, and they used all sorts of words that were complicated. One time I had a little girl come to school, and she was all scratched up, looked like she'd been sorting bobcats, and I said, "What happened to you? What happened to you?" And she said, "We've been picking gooseberries, and they're paying $1 a gallon for gooseberries," but she said, "You know, it takes an abundance of gooseberries to comprise a gallon."
The schools changed, though. It became the one-room school was no more, and you got out of teaching.
Well, I was not interested in teaching for teaching's sake. I had gone down there to learn the language, and I went from there. I had to find something to do, and there was a little 250-watt radio station in our hometown, Salem. And I got a job there because I was the only one that could pronounce Khrushchev or... I wasn't a very good radio announcer, but it gave me a shot at all the music that they had for that station and what they were doing. Like, all of my relatives and all of my friends had an instrument under the bed or hanging on a wall, and they didn't play it all the time, and they weren't professional at all, but it was the kind of thing that you would do if you got together and the other guy had a guitar and you had a fiddle. You'd get together and make music. And I thought, why is this station playing top 40 country music? This is ridiculous. So I started a program called Hickory Holler Time that was all bluegrass, which I loved immediately. And I did that for 9 years until I met the Dillard boys.
And you would listen to his program?
Never.
Never? Didn't listen to his program.
Did I lose my mic?
I listened to him. I lost mine too.
Yeah, we really did. I would listen to Mitch because there was no other station that we could pick up where we lived. So.
All right, folks, so there you're getting a preview. This is really like the introduction. So you've gotten all kinds of history of the Dillards right there, and I hope you have been enjoying that. The Dillards, wow, there's so much talent right there. You hear Mitch Jane and the stories he tells, and you hear Doug telling jokes as he's going through. Rodney's telling jokes. Dean's telling stories. You know, they're all just amazing men, and I was so fortunate to be able to see them play live several times together, and also to see Doug and Rodney play at other times, and Dean. It's just so nice. Now, I'll remind you that by this time, Mitch, he couldn't hear very well, so he wasn't playing with them. We mentioned that last week in the podcast, but he was still a part of the group and could really light up the room with his stories, as I know you heard there. All right, folks, I hope you're enjoying this as much as I'm enjoying being able to bring them to you. I want to thank Neil and Pat Coleman for providing the video that you're seeing. They're the ones I got the video of this sessions with Neil. So we got Neil Brower performing the session, and you got Neil and Pat Coleman providing me the videos that you're seeing. So in the coming weeks, you're going to hear a whole lot more from the Dillards. You've got 3 more episodes of this, and they're going to be talking more and more about the Andy Griffith Show as we move along. So I know you're going to enjoy it. This was all background and getting to know the Dillards, who later become the Darling Boys, and Maggie. I know you've enjoyed this, and definitely want to invite you to to just let me know what you think about it. We already had one voicemail, so you can leave one too if you would. You can give me a call at 888-684-8415. Had a voicemail from the last episode that we'll be sharing in a future episode here soon. I want to thank Paul Mulick for calling in. And I want to invite you to call in as well, 888-684-8415. You can email me at floyd@imaybury.com. And I really do appreciate hearing back from you. Help support the show by going over to patreon.com/2chairs and donate, $1 an episode or 50 cents an episode, whatever you want to do to help support the creation of Two Chairs No Waiting. I'd love to hear from you again, so we'll see you guys next time on Two Chairs. Good night, everybody.